Hold on. Gentlemen, take your seats. The next two cases have been combined because the issues are the same. However, the amount of time that's been granted for each case is as if it were individually granted. Consequently, the clerk will now call the first case, the Connor case.
Connor v. Glasgow et al., Ronald B. Thomas, Randall B. Chalk, Quality Counsel, Richard W. Sutter, Appellate.
Now, I will remind you all that they were combined because the arguments were the same, at least the issues were the same. To the extent that the arguments are the same, you don't have to repeat them. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, my name is Norman Thomas, and I'm here today with Randall T. Trost, co-counsel, and together we represent Terry Connor in this appeal. Ms. Connor asserts that the relevant statute, 8.01.66.1d, provides her with a remedy by which to address the alleged bad faith handling of her claim by her carrier, Liberty Mutual, and it was in the context of an underinsurance situation that she brought the claim.
It provides her with a remedy, but does it provide a duty on the carrier before the legal entitlement status has been determined?
Our position is that the duty was already there.
Well, where does that come from?
Well, if you go back, for example, to the Floyd case. The Floyd case was one of the cases after Aetna v. Price, which related to the obligation of an insurer, a motor vehicle insurer, to address a claim within the policy limits if possible. But in the course of its decision, the court said that it is presumed that all contracting parties act in good faith toward each other.
So there is an implied duty of good faith and fair dealing in Virginia for all contracts, including insurance contracts? That's the basis of the predetermination duty of the carrier?
Well, our position is that the duty of good faith in contracting, including in the insurance contract, has been established for a long time. Floyd articulated it. It talked about a relationship between the parties to deal fairly with claims.
But the distinction I'm trying to draw with you is that I caught your first remark, and that's exactly what I was thinking. Bad faith is a remedy statute. It presupposes a duty, doesn't create a duty. The breach of a bad faith duty presupposes a duty. Now the question is, okay, where does the duty come from? It obviously doesn't come from the remedial statute. If it comes from contract law, how is the contract not incorporating by reference the statute that imposes the liability on this carrier only after the underlying party has been a judge legally entitled to recover?
Well, to unpack that a bit, Your Honor, legally entitled to recover has been articulated by this court in the Aetna v. Dodson case to mean a legally enforceable right to recover against the tortfeasor. That deals with the remedy, as Aetna v. Dodson was the case, of course, that dealt with the fact that the workers' compensation statute provided Dodson's estate with the exclusive remedy of workers' compensation. And therefore, Dodson's estate could not satisfy the statutory prerequisite because Dodson's estate did not have a legally enforceable right to recover. Two things happened.
Well, before trial, you don't know if that legally enforceable right is imaginary or is worth $1 million.
We don't know the value of it, but what we do know is that Ms. Connor had a legally enforceable right to recover against Mr.
Suppose there's a defense on liability. You don't have a legally entitlement to recover if you don't have a legal cause of action, which presupposes that someone's going to have to adjudicate whether you have a duty of breach and damages.
Well, the cause of action, Your Honor, is the methodology by which she enforces her right. enforces against the tortfeasor the injury and the seeking of the compensation for that injury. She had a legally enforceable right to recover, and the court has indicated that satisfies the statutory language of legally entitled recovery to recover under 38.2.2206A.
Satisfies it in what sense?
Well, Your Honor,
it just makes you eligible, right? It means that you're in the ballgame.
It means that the tortfeasor is subject to legal liability. And that's what the court said in the Rainey case.
Right, but it seems like to me, we were saying that means you're within the scope of the UM policy. It's possible you might have a claim under UM policy if you satisfy that.
All right, it's not possible to have a claim. The claim is asserted without regard to whether any litigation has yet occurred. And whether
what do you mean by claim then?
A claim is the assertion of a legal right to recover under the policy.
But doesn't the claim have to be a then existing right?
She had the right to make the claim.
No. I mean, the claim has to be for something that you already are entitled to.
That's not our position, Your Honor. It has to be a potentiality of liability of the tortfeasor.
So in your scenario, if I have a hurricane policy, I can make a claim before the hurricane.
Not before the hurricane.
Yeah, because I'm making a claim. I go to my insurance company and says, pay me. I've got a weather report. A hurricane's going to be coming tomorrow. Go ahead and pay me. And you have a good faith obligation to pay me some money, even though the prerequisite under the contract for you paying me has not occurred yet.
Your Honor, that's not our thesis. The injury has to occur first. The car accident had to occur first. And Ms. Connor incurred injury in that accident.
Can I stop you for a second? But concerning the UM policy, the occurrence of the accident is not what triggers contractual liability. That's what makes it different from a first-party insurance policy or a third-party policy. That's why UM policies are different.
Well, there's not, Your Honor. But whether or not the insurer has the duty to act in good faith with respect to a given claim is not dependent on Ms. Connor having first obtained a judgment to do that.
But you see, good faith is a qualifier. It's good faith duty. It presupposes a duty. I have no doubt that we all, based upon our common morality, have good faith towards everyone, or should. But the law only recognizes breaches of duties. And bad faith breaches of duty are really bad breaches of duty, whereas non-bad faith is just a breach. So the thing that's circular about the argument to me is that, as Justice Goodwin's putting his finger on, the underlying duty is quite very literally defined. You have to have a legally entitlement to recover. Well, no plaintiff, before they get a actual recovery from a judge or a jury, has a legal entitlement to anything other than to keep asking. So how do you get around the literal language of the statute, which is incorporated by law into the policy?
Your Honor, our position is that it's not a matter of getting around it at all. The General Assembly well knew of the Midwest Mutual decision when it enacted 66.1 subpart D. In fact, it knew about Midwest Mutual in the first iteration of the statute, which was in 1977, a year after Midwest Mutual was decided. The statute pertains to the handling of claims. Claims occur before liability is established in virtually every instance.
Not in third party.
Well, Your Honor, with respect to this relationship, the relationship as to insured and uninsured or underinsured motorist coverage, a claim almost always will precede the commencement of litigation or at least the end of litigation.
But the question is, when does the duty respond? The duty to respond, when is that implicated? Obviously is implicated in a first-party context. And there's no Virginia law ever applying it to the UM-UIM context, so it seems to me you do have to get around the language of the statute that's incorporated into the policy.
Your Honor, to address the court's question, I'd like to bring attention to the St. John case. In that case, the court already applied the standard of reasonableness with respect to subpart A of the statute, presupposing that the insurer had a duty with respect to the claim in that case. And therefore, our position is that the duty that the court is inquiring about is already established by this court, by St. John, by Floyd, and even by the CUNA v. Norman case from which the standard of reasonableness was taken. And the standard of reasonableness requires, prior to any judgment being taken, a number of factors which relate both to the legislative history of this as well as to a parallel statute that gives the Commissioner of Insurance an opportunity to bring actions or sanctions against carriers that show a pattern of bad faith in the handling of claims. But three components of the standard of reasonableness are very relevant to this case. One is, did the carrier make a reasonable and prompt investigation? Number two, how did they handle? What did they do with the evidence that they discovered in that investigation? And number three, was their use of that evidence only for a settlement tool?
And but that would indicate that the structure of UM-UIM is the carrier comes in to defend the absent defendant with the purpose of defeating the plaintiff's claim. Am I right or wrong? That doesn't sound like good faith.
That
sounds hardly like good faith to me. If you have a good faith duty to the plaintiff, why would the statute engineer a situation where your whole job is to defeat the plaintiff's claim at trial?
There's a substantial difference between acting adversarially and acting in bad faith. And the General Assembly addressed that in this particular statute.
What did they say?
I didn't
see anything about that at all in the statute.
Well, they give the remedy for that which the court has already established as the duty. And again, when we go back to the St. John case, that duty is recognized in the court's jurisprudence already.
What duty are you talking about?
The duty to act in good faith or not in bad faith.
Yeah, but I think what Justice Kelsey's pointing out is the duty is going to be dependent upon the contract you're talking about. You're going to have different duties based upon the language of a particular contract.
Well, the elements of that duty are defined by the standard of reasonableness by which they are to handle claims.
So is it plausible to say the good faith is there, but it might operate differently in this context versus other contexts, but it's still there?
The factors all have to be considered at the trial court level with respect to whether the carrier acted not in bad faith or not with respect to a given claim. And that is why the standard of reasonableness is at least a six-factor test to evaluate all the circumstances that would apply.
Because clearly the carrier is in a different posture in this setting than defending its own insured and so on.
Yes, and it is. But there is a difference between adversarial and bad faith conduct. Ron, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
You have 2 minutes and 4 seconds.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Richard Southland, and I represent the Appalachian Liberty Mutual, who is the uninsured motorist carrier for the appellant, Terry Connor. Your Honors, this case arises in the context of a contractual relationship. It is the relationship between Terry Connor and Liberty Mutual, which is defined by their insurance contract. And the pleadings in this case have gotten bogged down, I think, in trying to recognize the difference between liability insurance, third-party liability insurance, and first-party auto insurance. And the UM-UIM provisions that are mandated by 38.2 2206 kind of make it into a hybrid of sorts, because it is not a true first-party relationship, because in a normal first-party relationship, which was the relationship between Nationwide and St. John in the St. John case, which is for, you know, your collision coverage or your medical payments coverage, as soon as the plaintiff, as soon as the insured makes a claim, then she suffered some type of damage as a result of the operation of a motor vehicle, either hers or someone else's, then there is an obligation for, she's established her right to recover under the policy. The only question that remains is the amount of the damages that are related to the coverage.
So is my recollection right? St. John's was a MedPay case.
Correct.
First-party MedPay case.
That is correct. St. John was attempting to recover medical payments under the medical payments coverage from her own policy, which is a no-fault provision. It is a provision. All St. John had to prove was that they were injured by the operation of a motor vehicle. It did not matter whether or not it was St. John's own operation of a motor vehicle that caused the injury, and therefore the damages that they were claiming, the medical bills that they were claiming, were related to those injuries.
So that clause was a first-party clause in a broader contract.
Correct. This case arises out of the question is, when does the duties of Liberty Mutual attach? When's the obligation of Liberty Mutual become that they have some obligation to act under the UIM provisions of the policy, which, as you pointed out, are mandated by 38.2206A. And the key phrase is the legal entitlement to recover. And as counsel pointed out, Aetna versus Dodson defined the phrase legal entitlement to recover as possessing a legally enforceable right to recover. Now, the appellant would like to make that I have the right to sue, therefore I have a legal entitlement to recover, but the only thing that is enforceable, that a person can be forced to pay on, is a judgment. And this court has been consistent, dating back to Willard v. Aetna in 1973, which, although it was determined under a North Carolina policy and therefore under North Carolina law, this court stated that if the case with Willard was suing Aetna on a Virginia policy, Willard could not file a direct action against its insurance company under Virginia law before judgment. Because, again, legal entitlement to recover is defined by a judgment. Midwest Mutual stated even more clearly that judgment is the event which determines legal entitlement to recover. Now, this continues in, Collin would like to rely on the footnote 6 in Aetna versus Dodson, stating that Midwest Mutual is inapposite as a clear indication that this court overruled Midwest Mutual. But all this court was noting was that although the part of Aetna would like to rely on Midwest Mutual, Midwest Mutual was factually distinguishable because of the way it arose. Midwest Mutual was a contribution action between two UIM carriers, one of which settled with the plaintiff pre-judgment and then was seeking contribution from the other uninsured motorist carrier for half of the judgment. And the court basically said, the gist of it is that when Midwest Mutual made its payment, it was a volunteer. It had no obligation. And in fact, this court, over a year after Aetna v. Dodson, reinforced that principle in State Farm versus Kelly. State Farm was attempting to take a credit against what it owed under a 2IM policy for a payment it had made satisfying a lien of the United States government under the Medicare Recovery Act, but it made that payment before judgment was entered. So it was attempting to then take the credit for that payment when it against the judgment amount, and the court stated that State Farm was not liable to the insured unless and until the insured is legally entitled to recover, and the judgment was the event which determines legal entitlement to recover. Therefore, when State Farm made the payment, it only did so as a volunteer, and therefore was not entitled to a credit. I think this court has been clear that phrase, legal entitlement to recover, is defined as a judgment. And you can look at other contexts, even the context that Aetna v. Dotson arose in, which is workers' comp. This court stated Aetna that the legal entitlement to recover was not satisfied in Aetna because the Dotson estate could not proceed to judgment against a fellow employee because of the workers' comp bar. Not that it didn't have a legal right to pursue a fellow employee, but it just could not do so through the tort system because of the workers' comp bar. Therefore, the workers' comp was the exclusive remedy, and they had the right to recover from the tortfeasor in that case, but only through workers' comp, only through the workers' comp system and the workers' comp insurer. So Aetna v. Dotson does not stand for the proposition that judgment is not the event that is necessary. Finally, if you look at what the legislature did also in 38.2.2206F to address a similar situation for workers' comp, which is they amended 2206F to include a vehicle and mechanism for a plaintiff to recover under her uninsured motorist carrier provisions against a statutorily immune tortfeasor. And the line of cases that led to that was essentially state police officers who had enjoyed sovereign immunity because of the way the accident occurred. 38.2.2206F now provides a mechanism for a injured plaintiff to file suit and get a judgment against the immune defendant, and that judgment under 2206F is legally enforceable against the carrier. But it's clear that the legislature was making judgment the event that defined legal entitlement to recover. In this case, Ms. Connor was not legally entitled to recover until the judgment was entered by the Spotsylvania County Circuit Court following the jury trial, and that was the point in time in which Liberty Mutual had an obligation under their contract to do anything vis-a-vis Ms. Connor's claims for damages. Therefore, prior to that judgment being entered, Ms. Connor had no legal entitlement to recover, and therefore Liberty Mutual had no obligation to Ms. Connor under the UIM provisions of her insurance contract. And unless there are any other questions, I'm going to submit this case to the court.
Thank you for your argument. Mr. Thomas, you have 2 minutes and 4 seconds left.
Two key points. First of all, the General Assembly, in enacting the relevant statute, 66.1D, did not make any differentiation whatsoever in an insured's ability to have their motor vehicle carrier treat them without bad faith, meaning this. It applied to MedPay coverage, it applied to motor vehicle liability coverage, and it applied to UIM coverage, because all of those coverages are part and parcel of the definition of a motor vehicle insurance policy under 38.2-124, which is specifically mentioned in the statute. All categories cannot be treated with bad faith. And the second point is, this court did not equate legally entitled to recover to judgment in the context of an insured in a UIM situation. Aetna v. Dotson especially said that is inapposite here. Midwest Mutual's holding is not germane here. And it said that legally entitled to recover is satisfied when one has a legally enforceable right to recover. And the Rainey case made clear that that means that the tortfeasor is potentially liable to the insured. That is, the uninsured or underinsured tortfeasor is potentially liable to the insured. And that satisfies the legally entitled to recover language because it constitutes the right of action, the legally enforceable right to recover damages against the tortfeasor. So the statement by Liberty of that fact is not correct according to this court's specific jurisprudence.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.